Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can also find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Trish Kenny. She's the author of a book called Silver Platter Girl. Right now, I'd like to welcome Ignatius Mombasa. He is a Zimbabwean writer and poet, and his first novel, Mapenzi, won the Zimbabwe Book Publishers Association Award for Best Shonen Novel of the Year in 1999, and it went on to be voted as one of the top 75 Zimbabwean books of the century. He will be reading at 222 Shelby Street Gallery today, July 30th. There's a gathering at 5 o'clock and a reading at 6 o'clock. And then tomorrow, Friday, he will be at the Santa Fe Children's Museum from 3:30 to 5 in the afternoon, doing some storytelling and reading of Zimbabwean folk tales. And also, Shono Slovakia Marimba will be there. And then finally, on Saturday, August 1st, from 7 to 9, he will be at the Pauly Swing Studio. We can give you more information about that a little later. Welcome, Ignatius, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
You are a poet and a writer, and you have chosen to write in Shona language, which is your native language, even though you speak fluent English. Why did you make that choice?
Thank you very much for that question. First of all, I'll say Shona is my mother language, whereas English is a language that I had to learn. Now, you'd of course appreciate that a language learned and a language acquired naturally, the one that you would have acquired naturally tends to be the language that you feel comfortable in. But having said that, you find that inspiration, for me, chooses its own language. In most cases, it chooses my mother language. So things just come to me in Shona, and I don't have to struggle to choose a language. So inspiration assists me there. But also, there is a big challenge in Zimbabwe where we face a risk of being a languageless people. The reason I say this is that very many young Zimbabweans, not even young, let me say many Zimbabweans these days are no longer as confident and comfortable speaking in Shona, writing in Shona. They'll tell you it's so hard for them to write or read in Shona. And certainly I think we risk losing a very rich culture, a very rich language that I think is, according to my fellow Zimbabweans, they see Shona and other local languages or indigenous languages as inferior to English. But again, this is something that has been put in their minds because of colonialism. Shona is not inferior. You can express any complex thoughts in Shona. So I've chosen Shona, or rather, let me say Shona chooses, you know, me,
right,
to express myself.
I think there's some place where you wrote that you want to write in the same language in which you cry, in which you laugh, in which you spoke to your mother when you were young.
Precisely. Because I tell you, there's nothing that's really difficult as when, you know, because I think when we want to express the deepest of emotions, one naturally does that in a language that they grew up speaking. I grew up speaking Shona. It is the language that I don't have to fight with. It loves me, and I love the language. So you'd find where I at times, you know, when I'm speaking to somebody in English, I have to struggle to think and find the right word. It just comes naturally in Shona. So it's a language that liberates me, if I may use that word.
Probably most or perhaps all of our listeners don't speak Shona, but I was hoping that you would read one of your poems in Shona so that people could get a sense of at least the music of your language.
All right. Thank you. I will read you a poem in Shona. It's called chirombo icho. Nunzi ya mara zvine mutsindo, rwaivi rwukamhanya sedzvatsvatsva. Ndianiko ariyambutsa dindingwe? Ndiwe here wariyambutsa dindingwe? Ndianiko ayambutsa chirombo icho? Ndanzwa hunga hunga. Zvanzi kudii? Zvanzi honye dzanyora kuti hadzichadyi chitunha chavigwa pachuru. Uyewo icho chitunha chanyorawo kuti chave kumbomira kuora kunhuwa. Ndianiko ariyambutsa dindingwe? Ndiwe here wariyambutsa dindingwe? Ndianiko ayambutsa chirombo icho? Ndanzwa hunga hunga. Zvanzi gondo rabvuma kuchengeta vana vehuku. Neshumba yabvuma kurara mumumvuri nemhembwe. Rovambira ratama mugomo. Rave kugara nevanhu richitamba nevana. Ndianiko ariyambutsa dindingwe? Ndiwe here wariyambutsa dindingwe? Ndianiko ayambutsa chirombo icho? Ngatirangarire kuti naJudas akatsvoda Jesu, uye kuti shoko rinoti vacharopafadzwa vanotenda kunyange vasina kuona. Apa ndanzwa, ndichatenda ndaona, ndabata. Ndianiko ariyambutsa dindingwe? Ndiwe here wariyambutsa dindingwe? Ndianiko ayambutsa chirombo icho?
Ignatius Mbasa, writing in Shona language, his native language. Now, do you have that poem translated into English, or can you tell us what it was about?
I have the poem translated in English, so maybe I can read you the...
Please do.
So, in English, basically, the title of the poem is Who? The mosquito has landed with a thud, and George Bush googles for answers. In the jungle, the lion will not sleep tonight. The curious chameleon flips book pages, a tatty Encyclopedia Britannica to understand. Baboon is surprised at the news that has made his crafty cousin, monkey, fall from a tree. Who has helped the cheetah escape? Is it you who held the door and bowed? Even the owl hoots. Who has helped that beast cross the line? I've also heard the rumor, but I will not Google. Internet connection is bad here. I'll just wait for God. I, like Thomas, will believe when I see, touch, and perhaps smell. I hear maggots have vowed not to decompose carcasses, and carcasses have agreed not to rot and smell. Who has helped the cheetah escape? Is it you who held the door open and bowed? Even the owl still hoots. Who helped that beast cross the line? Rumor says that the eagle has trimmed its talons and is now babysitting the chicken's little ones. The lion has agreed to recline in the same shed and manicure the warthog's muddy hooves. And the black mamba has left its mountain haven to become domestic, to help the cat catch rats. Who has helped the cheetah escape? Is it you who held the door open and bowed? Even the owl still hoots. Who has helped that beast cross the line? The weaver bird is as puzzled as the tortoise, but the crow, with his white collar, reminds us. Remember, even Judas betrayed Jesus Christ. And indeed, we must find the answer. Who has helped the cheetah escape? Is it you who held the door open and bowed? The all wants to know who is my enemy now. It was better when I knew.
Ignatius Mbasa, it's so there's a lot of things to talk about just in that poem, but one of the first things that struck me is the use of that sound, who, both as a word and as an animal sound. And is that also what's operating in Shona?
In Shona, actually, Well, you've asked a very interesting question. You won't find this same word or same line in Shona, although I'm sure when you were listening to the Shona, the same questions are being asked. One thing, I translate my own poems for many reasons, but why you find that the play or this, you know, the play with words and sounds in the English on where the owl is hooting and asking who, is something that I really say is a good accident, in that when I translate my poetry, because I am the writer, I also get the opportunity to recreate certain things, but not recreating them so as to throw out the meaning in the Shona poem completely. I have the freedom that probably somebody who would have translated this may not have had.
So in a way, it's a new poem in English.
You can say that, although very much the framework is based on the Shona poem.
I was thinking about this, all the questions that come up when you are a writer who's lived under British colonial rule, and the legacy of colonialism, even after independence, is very strong and somewhat complicated. And not only do you want to write in your native language, but you want to have a broader audience, and you probably would have a broader audience in English. So in a way, you are doing two different things for two different audiences.
Yes, it's said that we have to use English, because English is becoming, you know, almost a global language. But at the same time, you'd find again that among the people in Zimbabwe, the number of people who don't understand English is also big. So it's also very useful to write and reach those people who are not as fluent and as eloquent in English, or who don't comprehend English most urban people. So there's that need, not for us to get carried away or to get excited about just taking care of one side. It's good to market my writings or to get opportunities to interact and be published internationally, but also, you know, we should not forget that we have our local constituencies.
So tell us more about your local constituencies. Are there a lot of book readers and poetry readers and also listeners? Because I imagine poetry is spoken as aloud as much as it's read.
Mm. Thank you. Readers, no. Zimbabwe has been going through very difficult economic challenges and political problems, so buying books becomes a luxury. We have schools that, you know, don't have textbooks, and so you can imagine where bread and butter issues are, sustenance issues or matters are at the fore. You know, somebody would see buying a book as a luxury. So what happens is I've been prompted to actually move a step further, because I know for sure that the majority of our people, they may not afford books, but they listen to the radio, for example. So I have gone on to record my poetry with music, and that way I know for sure that a good number of, you know, Zimbabweans get to enjoy the poetry.
And so are you, I would imagine that you're also active in the work of cultivating other youths in Zimbabwe.
Absolutely. I work with the Budding Writers Association of Zimbabwe, and then in my day-to-day work, I work for the British Council, which is a UK cultural relations organization. Some of our projects and work is about, you know, helping young writers, young poets, refine their skills, take their art to a much higher level. So we've been doing quite a lot of work in that area as an employee of the British Council. And then apart from that, you know, as a citizen, as a writer, I am one person who is open to, you know, young people coming to me and say, who would want you to help us polish our work. And also because my novel and some of my poetry is being studied in schools and universities, I also go out, you know, to talk about my novel, my writings, and it's a good opportunity for me to interact with these young people, young writers, and, you know, I, in the process, help them, in any way that I can.
Is the British Council supportive of your work in Shona language as opposed to English?
Very much. They, I've got a very supportive, boss, and generally, you know, even the regional director and, you know, other colleagues within British Council in the region, they know I'm a poet, I'm a storyteller, I'm a writer, and I have made it very clear that I write in Shona because the British Council is a cultural relations organization. They know that, you know, when you talk of culture, you're talking of so many, artifacts and so many forms of culture, and language is one of the forms, you know, many forms that you find. Of course, you know, being British, you know, teaching English is one of the British Council's global aims, but, you know, they really, you know, work mutually and respect, you know, the local context that they operate in.
We're talking to Ignatius Mombasa, and he will be here tonight and through the weekend. We'll be talking more about that once again at the end of the program. We know from the news about the terrible human rights situation in Zimbabwe, about the debacle of the last elections, about Robert Mugabe, about the resistance and opposition movements, and how people in them have been, you know, tortured, had their houses burned down, have been killed, and so on. You are a writer within that context. How do you express yourself politically? Do you always have to speak in metaphor? And is that not pretty transparent to the powers that be?
Thank you very much. I think when you face a situation that requires you to speak, and yet you know that speaking may, you know, create problems, you have to be creative about how you do it. My novel, for example, is one, you know, beautiful political satire. So really, if you look at it, most of my work is, you know, very almost lighthearted. But if you look deep down, it's multi-layered, and, you know, I suppose that's probably the best way to, you know, express yourself or oneself under difficult circumstances, because, you know, if you are too open about it, also then, you know, in terms of, you know, being an artist, you may be failing. Look at George Orwell's, you know, Animal Farm. Beautiful story, you know, which can pass as a fable, but, you know, touching on really key or serious political issues. So that's how, you know, I have survived. I survived through satire writing, exploiting humor, where people can laugh, but, you know, underneath, you know, if they pause, they'll realize, you know, I'm talking about, you know, serious issues that need, you know, to be addressed.
You grew up on your grandfather's farm herding cattle, and your father was a supportive of the Zimbabwean liberation struggle. He died in a landmine in 1975, and I wanted to let people know also that on Friday, Jody Williams is going to be in Santa Fe. She's the Nobel Peace Prize laureate who's very powerful organizing work resulted in the banning of landmines internationally. So coincidentally, she's here this weekend at the Santa Fe Convention Center on Friday night. But tell us more about your family and what your hopes were in that liberation and what your father's hopes were in the liberation struggle at that time.
I think I can tell you that before independence, there was, you know, what I would call unit of purpose among the Zimbabweans. Almost everybody, black, wanted, you know, the country to be liberated, wanted to see justice, you know, restrictions in terms of where you can go and where you can't go in terms of travel. You know, it was, we were under apartheid and basically, you know, like South Africa. And we, it was our wish and our hope that, you know, the liberation struggle would bring about, you know, equality, would bring about a system that values people's lives and respects people's, you know, lives. So that was, you know, all our wish. And very much, as I say there, you'll notice that the liberation struggle in Zimbabwe was very much a process that was assisted by the masses. The people played a very important role because the war was fought, you can say, by the people, in that they were supporting, sheltering, feeding, clothing the liberation or the freedom fighters. So people were doing all this knowing that one day, you know, when what we are fighting for is realized, we will all be happy, we'll all be free. Life, you know, we'll have equal opportunities, basically. So that was the main purpose, and that was, you know, the greatest hope that, you know, the Zimbabwean people had as a nation, and even, you know, considering my family as part of the Zimbabwean, you know, nation. So it's a pity that, you know, I lost my father during the struggle, but in any war there are casualties, and, you know, some people have to die. But it's a pity that, you know, when the values that, you know, people who fought in the war, you know, and died for, are no longer, you know, what we see today, then it becomes, you know, something that's really difficult to stomach.
It's a terribly sad situation when the hope of liberation is then dashed pretty quickly by a leader whose aim is more of about his own power than returning that power to the people. Zimbabwe seems to have a very resilient culture and a very fighting spirit. What is the source of that resilience?
I think we naturally are peace-loving people. You come to Zimbabwe anytime, one thing that you tell me is that the people are very warm. But also, we were just coming out of a long war. You know, the Liberation War, the second Chimurenga that resulted in our independence in 1980, started in 1966. So, you know, from 1966 to 1980, a lot of people had, you know, seen relatives die, you know, people displaced. Too many things were happening, you know, during that time. So, naturally, people would, you know, want a situation where they quickly forget such, you know, harrowing experiences, where it wasn't a good war, I must tell you. You know, a lot of people died. So you look at a situation like that, and you realize that when people are independent and they are excited and looking forward to improved livelihoods and, you know, better lives, and something goes wrong, and there's use of force and, you know, to silence the people, then it becomes, you know, something that breaks the people's spirits. But the fact that people had just come out of, you know, one long war, you know, going back to into another war again, people still had, and they still have, you know, memories about, you know, what, you know, the war, the Liberation War, you know, was and what it did to them. Most of them, I can say, they are emotionally bruised and they are still nursing wounds from, you know, that Liberation War. And naturally, people would say, we'll just wait and hope that, you know, sanity will prevail at the end of the day.
We hear so much about not only Zimbabwe, but other African countries through the news when there's a crisis going on, we know very little about the beauty of Zimbabwe. Tell us about the geography, the culture, the land.
Oh. You know, in among my people, we've got a proverb that says, "Kutaurirwa hunyima mbaredze kumsana." Roughly or loosely translated, you know, if I tell you about, let's say, a wart that's, you know, on your back, even if I try and describe it, because you don't see it, you can't really get to understand, you know, how big or small or, you know, cancerous
right.
or whatever it is. So I could try and describe or tell you, you know, what Zimbabwe is like, but I'll tell you the weather is as beautiful as, you know, the Santa Fe weather here. Very good climate. We've got very good, you know, infrastructure, which, you know, unfortunately has, you know, taken a knock or has been affected by all these economic and political problems. We have, you know, the best of probably game reserves. We boast of the best human resources in Southern Africa. Unfortunately, I probably would even say in Africa. Unfortunately, the thing is, you know, because of the economic challenges, a lot of our people, more than 3 million people, are living outside Zimbabwe.
Right.
And, you know, their skills, their knowledge is benefiting our neighbors, you know, in other countries, which is quite a shame, because those people, you know, if they were in Zimbabwe, would actually be making things, you know, move and progress well. We have a happy people. I think I've said this: happy, very warm, very, you know, patient and understanding people. You need to come to Zimbabwe to, you know, appreciate the things that I'm telling you.
I know. I mean, I think so many people listening, just for me personally, listening to the language makes me want to go to a place where that is the language that you hear on the street, because it has a music to it. What is your musical culture like in Zimbabwe?
We have, you know, when you go back to the traditional, you know, we have got, you know, drumming as part of music. We have got music that is mainly composed and, you know, played in the rural areas by young men and young women. We've got, you know, choral music. We've got the famed Mbira thumb piano, which I can tell you is a unique musical instrument that is probably, I can say, best played in Zimbabwe by Zimbabweans. We've got, you know, great Mbira players in Zimbabwe. We also have marimbas. I think they're called xylophones.
And you've noticed the Zimbabwean music culture here in Santa Fe. There's so many marimba bands and people who play mbira.
I, you know, was quite wild. I said, I can't believe my eyes. So I'm actually looking forward to interacting with some of the people that, you know, are playing this kind of music. And you'll notice that most of the groups that are playing here in Santa Fe, in the U.S., are playing, you know, the great traditional tunes that we've known, you know, Nemamsasa, Maororo, Machena. Those are the, you know, great, great old traditional tunes from Zimbabwe. It's a joy to, you know, listen to the music. And of course, we've got our modern artists, you know, who play beautiful music. You know, you've got your Oliver Mtukudzi's, Alick Machesu, Thomas Mapfumo, who is, you know,
very
now
famous.
Best here.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we've got a lot of, you know, good music.
So the legacy of colonialism, in one sense, I mean, colonialism was done away with when Zimbabwe achieved its independence on the one hand, but the legacy of colonialism is still with you. How does that express itself?
Well, as you can see, that, you know, the legacy of colonialism is what has come, you know, to destroy us today, you know, through the land reform, you know, that our president decided to do, mainly being that, you know, when Zimbabwe was colonized in 1890, the British moved in, took the best land, and, you know, the best land to farm, and pushed, you know, the native Zimbabweans, you know, in areas that didn't have good soils. So you'd find that...
They did that here, too.
Oh, so we've got, you know, a lot in common. So that having, you know, happened, you'd find that we have had to, since 1890, when the Pioneer Column, you know, moved into Zimbabwe, we have had a problem that needed to be addressed, but then was wrongly addressed, and resulted in the situation we find ourselves in today. You know, a lot of us Zimbabweans, you know, are not against, you know, land reform or land redistribution. Land has to be redistributed and, you know, equally, but I can't just, you know, it can't just be redistributed arbitrarily. It doesn't make sense to take somebody who is trained as a teacher or somebody who is a soldier, or, you know, farming requires skills, it requires the knowledge. If we had approached, you know, the land redistribution wisely and from an informed point of view, we would have done well. But, you know, to answer or to come back to your question, you know, so you would find that the challenge we have today, you know, regarding, you know, the economic and political problems in Zimbabwe, it's, you know, a problem that goes back to colonialism. And, you know, these are things that didn't, you know, that were not corrected, and we are where we are today because of, you know, those problems from way back. Mm.
We just have another couple of minutes before we go. Tell us about what you're working on now. You have another novel, and I think I read somewhere that you said this is going to be your last novel?
Yes, because, you know, writing doesn't pay. It takes a lot of your time. I'll probably concentrate on writing poetry. You know, poetry is much shorter, and, you know, in one line, two lines, three lines, you have expressed yourself and said what you want to say. But I think it's more a problem of, you know, spending a lot of time or sacrificing a lot of time, you know, where you should be with your children and wife, you know, writing. And then, you know, you're not rewarded. So it becomes, you know, I end up writing for the love of writing. But in terms of, you know, saying I am making a living, you know, from my writings, that's not it.
But you do have one more book in the
pipeline. I have
one
more book, yes. It's almost done. It's just that, you know, I need to tie loose ends here and there.
Ignatius Mombasa is a Zimbabwean writer and poet, and he will be reading once again tonight at the 222 Shelby Street Gallery. There's a gathering at 5 o'clock and then a reading at 6. And then he will be at the Santa Fe Children's Museum along with Shona Slovakia Marimba tomorrow, Friday, July 31st, from 3:30 to 5 in the afternoon. Storytelling, reading Zimbabwean folk tales. And then on Saturday, August 1st, from 7 to 9 at the Poly Swing Studio at 2946 Santeros, which is on the south side of Agua Fria between Jemez and Lopez Lane. You can write to me if you need any information. You can write to radiocafe@ksfr.org. And I will also link at my website, santafe radiocafe.org, to Ignatius's website, which is pamabasa.com. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break right now, and we'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Trish Kenny. She's the author of the book Silver Platter Girl, and she will be reading from her book at Collected Works Bookstore as a benefit for the Santa Fe Rape Crisis and Trauma Treatment Center on Friday, July 31st at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's really great to be here.
Thank you so much. This is a very intense book about healing from childhood sexual abuse, and I find it a kind of a fascinating, if sometimes difficult, to go along with you on journey, because one of the things that's so difficult is that when you figure out what actually happened, that's only the beginning of the journey. Figuring out what happened and confronting parents, perpetrators, and so on doesn't result in instant healing. It's a very long process.
That is so absolutely true and very intuitive of you to figure out so quickly. My book is my way of finishing a very long process, as you say, of completely ridding myself of the ramifications and residue of being raised in a sexually abusive environment. One in four of us have some type of sexual abuse in our history, and it causes a lot of trouble. And it takes a long time to figure out what happened and what kind of trouble it's actually causing. In my case, I spent years trying to find more traditional ways of getting rid of it because I didn't want it in my life. I was in a relentless pursuit of living without that residue. And for me, it ended up being a physical disease.
So in your case, and this is another thing that's very interesting about the book, the pain and real suffering and trauma that you experienced and that you were having a hard time getting rid of, in some kind of alchemical way, at least in your view, transformed itself into a cancerous tumor, and the healing of that tumor was analogous to or identical with the healing of the trauma.
Absolutely, and that is my story. And I understand that some people find it difficult to believe maybe from a scientific point of view, and actually there is science now that would lead you to believe that the medical community is starting to understand and accept this a little bit more. But for me, it was not so much the actual abuse, which in my case was not severe or lifelong, but it was the adult ramifications of that abuse that became so difficult to manage. And in my case, I had a very successful outward life, very happy, vibrant marriage and a very successful career. And I had a secret life, and this is the life that I had learned was, so important and so powerful to a woman from my father. And I had a relationship in that secret life that was very destructive. It was not actually an affair. It was just a sort of an addiction to feeling desired in that way. And I continued to indulge in it, even though it was literally destroying me. And when it finally reached a point where it just couldn't continue anymore, after a fairly traumatic experience with that person, 3 days later, I had a tumor in my right breast that I could see. Didn't take a mammogram to find. And I believe that all of that stress that had finally reached that ultimate climax, that I put it all into that tumor. And I know that when it was removed, I felt immediate relief. When I was diagnosed, I felt immediate relief. I felt I was getting sick to get well. Now, I didn't realize how sick I was getting, and I ended up with a bone marrow transplant, which for me was an incredible transformational rebirth. And I think that is the moment when I realized that I was going to have the very unusual opportunity to have a dramatic, almost instantaneous healing in a sterile room. And that's what happened to me.
I think it's important to talk about the reality for sexual abuse survivors that it's not just about rape and it's not even just about physical touch. It's as much about the attitude in the house, you describe it very well in a kind of horrifying way, the lascivious kind of Playboy magazine attitude that was going on, and the denial of it, and the complicity of the other parent, in your case, the mother, in what was happening.
Yes, and I think that it's very important. When I first realized all of a sudden what the truth was in my family, it was from listening to Oprah Winfrey when she was this was in the late 70s, when she was first coming out about her sexual abuse. And ironically, the part of the program that really stayed with me was that it didn't have to be rape. It could be the way that you were looked at, the way that you were touched that made you uncomfortable, or a way that you felt sexualized. And that's what gave me the courage to say, this is what's wrong with me, and this is what's wrong with my family, because I believed that even though I had been molested by my father, that, you know, that didn't rise to the level of something I could really make a case for, or that could possibly cause all of these problems that I was having. But I believed Oprah when she said it didn't have to be rape, and I immediately confronted my father by letter. And I immediately called my sister and said, oh, my gosh, I figured it out. And that was when I first began to realize that my sister had been sexually abused by my father throughout her entire life.
What's interesting reading your book is that the writing is on the wall the whole time. But, of course, children and even young adults don't know how to recognize it.
Exactly. I mean, as a child, you really don't have a choice. You believe that your family is a normal family. Even if you feel conflicted and confused, those are your parents. And in the case of it being a close family member. And 83%, I believe it is, of childhood sexual abuse comes from a close family member. And it's also the least reported for obvious reasons. It's very hard to tell on one of your parents, especially when, you know, the entire family revolves around that type of activity and that type of the way we see things. So, but I think it changes when you get to be an adult, because then your behaviors are more under your control. Now, I shouldn't say that exactly, because we develop addictions, which are very hard to control. But at least you're not living in that household and have no ability to, you know, figure out what's happening to you. As an adult, you begin to have a choice. And even though it's very hard for abuse victims to realize that they have a choice, because that's part of what abuse is a lot of control and secrecy. But if you can figure that out, then that's the beginning. If you can tell someone, if you can begin to look at the truth yourself, and decide that you really want to get out of the clutches of that entire situation, that's when I believe healing begins. And that's why I decided to, after being well from my disease for 12 years, I decided that I wasn't finished. That, you know, I used to give keynote speeches about my remarkable recovery from cancer, and I would link it to trauma, but I wouldn't say what the trauma was. And I finally decided that was wrong, that I needed to tell the whole story, because if I couldn't tell the story as well as I had gotten, then how could you expect anyone who wasn't as fortunate as me to begin to tell their story?
How did your family respond to the publication of the book? Your sister, who also went, you know, lived in the same family and experienced some of the same things that you did, responded in a very different way, as you describe in the book. She got into bad marriages and had a life that on the surface was falling apart, whereas yours on the surface was very together. Then you wrote this book. How did your sister respond to it? How did your parents respond to it?
Well, I think this is the most complicated part of any interview that I do, because it's difficult for people to understand. But I don't have an active relationship with my parents anymore. My parents still do not accept what happened in our family. They don't want to talk about it. They don't love the truth as much as I do. My mother still lives in a great deal of denial. So I don't really have an active relationship with them. And as far as I know, they aren't even aware that the book's been published or that I've written the book. And I'm okay with that. They will find out, and I will tell them, and I will let them know. But I don't see them, and I don't speak with them. So, you know, I do have a very lightweight writing relationship with them, you know, mostly holiday cards and that type of thing. But as far as my sister goes, her life is very difficult. She hasn't worked in many years. She has a lot of health problems, as many sexual abuse survivors do. She has a lot of emotional and mental health issues, and she's pretty much a shut-in in her small home, and she is still very, very deeply involved with my parents. And the reason for that, I believe, is that, you know, she was taught from a very early age that their needs were more important than hers. And that's a lesson that she learned very, very well. And for example, they're having their 60th wedding anniversary next week, and the only guest at the anniversary is my sister. I have, even though I dedicated the book to her, she's been undergoing, you know, some surgeries and some difficult problems, and I have yet to sit down and talk to her about it. And I, you know, I'm concerned because it will be difficult for her to understand what I've done and why.
Another thing that struck me about the book was that while the abuse was specific to your family, there is a tone to the sexualization in the family that is cultural and that is not specific to your family. In other words, the kind of, there's a scene early in the book where you and your sister are posing as if you were Playboy bunnies, and your mother is unhappy that your father has left these magazines around for you to find, and he's delighted. And that moment struck me as something that is kind of a more large-scale cultural disease, so that even those people who are not directly affected by an individual are kind of affected by that ethos.
And I agree with you completely. My father kept the magazines around, and it wouldn't surprise me if he didn't try and hide them very well. He probably wanted us to see them. But I don't think that the part about little girls, you know, seeing those kinds of magazines and then pretending to be the models in the magazine is probably that uncommon. What I found uncommon about it, even at my young age at the time, was that my father was looking at us in a way that was chilling. My father was titillated by the experience. And that's what made my household sexually abusive, is that he was looking at it sexually, looking at us sexually. It excited him. And I don't necessarily mean that, you know, he wanted to molest us at that moment. What I mean is that exactly what you're saying, he was excited at the notion that we had found the naked pictures and we were posing naked. And that was, I agree, it was a cultural kind of thing. However, you have to add that my father was an Air Force fighter pilot. And I actually did a radio interview a few days ago with a woman. And she told me that, you know, after all, he was a fighter pilot. And I said, well, you know, that's the excuse my father used to use, is that he was a fighter pilot, and that's just the way fighter pilots are. And I told the host that I didn't believe that was an excuse, and she said, well, it's not an excuse, it's a style. So that's a cultural thing to me as well, you know, that there's a type of man who we can excuse this behavior from because it's kind of part of the culture of fighter pilots. That's unacceptable.
Well, not only that, but the culture of fighter pilots or the culture of the military sexualizing women in that way leads to a lot of much larger problems that have to do with rape, torture, militarism, and colonial exploitation of other people. I mean, it's not just, it doesn't stay in the family.
Well, my father once told me that there was no such thing as rape, because all women wanted sex all the time, therefore it was always consensual. And that was also part of, you know, my sister and I had that kind of upbringing, that we were told that women could use their sexuality for power, and that's how they would control men, and that's how they would get ahead in business, and the Playboy generation was a great place to be, and that we should take full advantage of it. So I agree with you. These were very much my father's perception of the 60s and the culture that was changing. And he was very jealous that we were being allowed to live in that kind of society before we made permanent decisions like getting married.
Well, unfortunately, we were out of time. But if people would like to continue the conversation, Trish Kenny, author of the book Silver Platter Girl, will be reading at Collected Works Bookstore as a benefit for the Santa Fe Rape Crisis and Trauma Treatment Center on Friday, tomorrow, July 31st at 6 in the evening. Trish, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR is streaming live on the web 24/7 at ksfr.org. You can email me at the email address radiocafe@ksfr.org. You can listen to the show, if you missed it in the morning, on the podcast site, santaferadiocafe.org. It's there thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services of Santa Fe. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz presents the final survey of July Artists of the Month, Ruby Braff, Ralph Sutton, and Paul Smith. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, we'll see you tomorrow. Robert Knott will be here, and much, much more. Ciao.